You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, December 3rd, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Pramila Nadesan, professor of history at Columbia University and author of Household Workers Unite, Untold Stories of African American Women Who Built a Movement. Also on the program today, 14 dead, 17 wounded by two now dead assailants in a mass shooting in San Bernardino, and nothing else is at this point confirmed as to the motivations of this shooting. Very strange scenario. A married couple, or at least a couple that shared a six-month-old infant, went on a shooting spree at the man's colleague's holiday party. Also on the program today, a potential Republican shutdown of our government could be on the horizon. And the Obama administration, meanwhile, is prepared to bypass student loan servicers in a move that is long overdue and receiving plaudits. Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton breaks with Rahm Emanuel and calls for feds to head to Chicago to investigate, I guess, the investigation around Laquan McDonald killing. And the Republican Senatorial Reelection Campaign Committee deems Donald Trump a misguided missile and says it's one that we should follow. We should also add that after we talk to Pramila Nadesan and discuss this horrible shooting in San Bernardino and what little we know at this point, we will also play some audio of Donald Trump on the Alex Jones program. And that will not be fictional. That will actually be real audio that we play. We also have audio that we'll play later in the program of Ted Cruz's raw footage that he apparently put up there. It's sort of a fascinating story that we'll get into later in the program about Ted Cruz trying to avoid election law problems by posting raw footage for campaign ads on an open public YouTube channel so that his super PAC could get a hold of this footage and create their own ads, but with material that is presumably sanctioned by the Cruz campaign because they directed it. We'll talk about that later. You know, look, we're going to talk about a little bit about this mass shooting. Obviously, tomorrow Cliff will be on the program. He'll want to talk about it more because, frankly, there was actually two mass shootings yesterday. That brings to, I don't know, three, four this week. It's unclear if yesterday was, I mean, I think everyone would sort of argue on some level that it was terrorism. Although, you know, I think I'm one of those people who still believe that you should maintain the definition of terrorism involving attacks on civilians to further a political agenda. And I don't know that that's what that was in San Bernardino. It seems a very strange scenario for it to just be a disgruntled worker, but it also seems a very strange scenario for it to be some type of broader political motivation behind it. And I imagine we'll know more. It's possible we won't know all the answers, even, you know, at the end of the day, which, you know, if that's the case, then they were very bad terrorists. Because if the greater public does not have a sense that there's more possible attacks to come, or there's a broader ideology behind it, that's not really terrorism. And I'm one who thinks that that word should have a meaning, so that we don't have a government that is able to basically strip us of our individual civil liberties, because every time there's a crime committed, they deem it terrorism, and therefore we need to have more surveillance. So I think we have to be very careful with that. But there's also, I say that because there's only so much that we can do here in this program, you know, where it goes beyond, you know, there's only so much analysis we can offer. Beyond that, it becomes a sort of porn on some level. So we will talk about it. But, you know, obviously there are reporters who are out there and you can get more details from there. But, you know, I just want to make that point about it because I don't think it makes sense to call things terrorism that are not terrorism. When a guy goes in and shoots up an abortion clinic, he clearly is trying to make other abortion providers afraid and imply and open the door for other people to go and do this, right? There's an ideology behind it. When jihadists do this in France, there's an ideology behind it. That the implication is that they're trying to terrorize with the hopes of pushing forward an ideology and a larger fear. You shouldn't be invading our countries or whatnot or whatever it is. In this case, it's not clear that that's what that was. It's very strange, though. It's extremely. I think it's a baffling case. But we will talk more about that. But we're also going to try and cheer everybody up in the fun half today by playing clips of Ted Cruz and Donald Trump on the Alex Jones program. I mean, that's just that's part of it. And tomorrow, you know, Cliff is going to have more to say about the access that people have to guns, regardless of what the motivations are for this type of shooting. You know, people have access to guns. And I know it's not guns that kill people. It's people who kill people. But, I mean, isn't it really, is it people? I mean, aren't people just being used to do God's will? Isn't that, I mean, I get confused. Isn't it God killing people? Isn't it God killing people?
iPhones don't play music. People play music.
That's true. That's a good point. That's a very good point.
I like how it's all like a mean version of college freshman talks. Like, think about it, man.
That's right.
Think about it.
It's we're going to do guns, this. Man. Maybe we'll start doing like, you know, way throwback Thursdays, and we all just do the show after a huge with like a 4 foot bong. You know, speaking of 4 foot bong,
you don't,
huh? No. Oh, okay. I just do my one hitter before I get on.
Matt and I are off in the garbage room with that, taking care of business.
Well, speaking of 4 foot bongs, if you no longer are looking for a bong for holidays or something like that. As a gift, yeah. Right?
That's good.
Was that a good?
It's elegant.
Well, everybody knows what a pain in the butt it is to give gifts at this time of season. Time of year. I guess the season of the year. It's extremely stressful. I'm about to reduce your stress, folks. Harry's. It's an awesome idea for a gift. man or woman. Harry's has something for every guy and gal out there. Doesn't matter if it's Secret Santa or your dad or your grandpa, your uncle, or even like your grown nephew, right? You're somebody's nephew, right, Matt? Look at you.
Multiple people's nephews.
And you recently started shaving, right?
Yeah, just earlier this summer.
It's
how's it going?
Harry's has holiday shaving sets at all different price points, starting at $15. As a special offer for my listeners, Harry's will give you $5 off your first purchase when you go to harrys.com and enter promo code MajorityReport. Harrys.com is streamlined. It's easy to use. It takes less than 30 seconds to place an order. They got great customer service, and it's a great gift. It's a full-on, legit, great gift. Go to harrys.com right now. You get $5 off your first order with the code MajorityReport if it's your first order. Don't wait. Free shipping for the holidays ends on December 10th. Act now. That's Harry's, HARRYS.com. Enter the code MajorityReport. Harry's makes every morning feel like a holiday, and it will make it much easier for you to give some gifts this year. So check it out. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Pramila Nettison. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Pramila Nettison. She is a professor of history at Barnard College at Columbia University and author of Household Workers Unite, Untold Stories of African-American Women Who Built a Movement. Welcome to the program, Pramila.
Thank you so much, Sam, for having me.
Oh, excuse me. Give me one. There we go. All right. So let's, I wanted to start, with, I mean, just the untold part of this story. Because I mean, I think as I was, reading it over, I was like, wow, this is really sort of like a secret history. And then I realized the subtitle was Untold. Why do you think that this part of organizing has been, so submerged in many ways?
I think there are a couple of reasons. One is our dominant perceptions of domestic workers. And I think there's an overriding assumption of domestic workers as victimized, as unorganizable, as helpless. And this is rooted in a very long history of the mammy stereotype of African-American women who were content and loyal servants. We also see it in the news coverage today. You pick up the newspaper today and you read about domestic workers who've been exploited or enslaved, essentially. And I think it's perpetuated in popular culture through films like The Help, which does see domestic workers generally as disempowered. So I think that dominant perception of domestic workers is one reason. The other reason, I think, is because we have a fairly circumscribed view of labor and labor organizing. Our understanding of labor is centered on a white male industrial model of the factory worker. And so I think in many ways, domestic work is kind of outside the purview of what we think of as labor. And so therefore, when we talk about organizing and labor organizing, I think household workers are very often not a part of that conversation.
You know, I mean, I think that that part of it there, and that is that that notion of the nature of who the people were that were working in these positions, the fact that they are sort of overlooked or perceived as not being in the workforce or in some way or not being it was in part by design, right? I mean, I think I first sort of came across your book in the context of some other interviews we did, which talked about how there were certain professions that were specifically excluded in the New Deal and New Deal labor laws and whatnot, and domestic workers were one of them. I mean, talk about that as a both as a function of like who were filling those roles, right? I mean, had domestic workers been, I guess, in the 20s and the 30s, white men who were all, I don't know, identified themselves as handymen, we may have seen them be included in New Deal labor regulations.
Absolutely. So in the 1930s, when the New Deal was passed, the vast majority of domestic workers were African-American women, many of them in the South, but increasingly in the North as well with the Great Migration. And the racial politics really played a profound role in why domestic workers were excluded from labor legislation. And if you look at the debates in Congress, a lot of those debates were about who was to be included in legislation like the Fair Labor Standards Act, which guarantees workers' minimum wage, or the Social Security Act, or unemployment compensation. And the racial politics essentially suggested that African Americans, both agricultural workers and domestic workers, would not be included in this legislation. And I think that was for a couple of reasons. One, because Southern Democrats, whose support was absolutely essential for the passage of the New Deal, refused to grant these kinds of labor protections to African-American workers for fear that it would disrupt the racial and social order of the South. But in addition to that, I think even Northern reformers and unions such as the AFL at that time, the American Federation of Labor, had a vested interest in a particular model of who a worker was. And they had been organizing in factories since the end of the 19th century. And so their vision of who a worker was in fact centered on a factory worker. So I think the question of who is populating the occupation has a lot to do with the kinds of rights and the kinds of protections that workers are guaranteed.
I mean, dig into just a little bit more about that that sense of Northern unions as to, you know, what constituted a worker. I mean, because was it simply sort of a habit at that point? Was it a function of, you know, a sense by the labor leaders that they needed to provide the workers that they're providing representation with a sense that you guys are on the totem pole, you know, you're not at the bottom of the totem pole. I mean, what was behind that? Was it, or was it just simply racism?
Mm-hmm. Racism played a huge role in that. So the American workforce, really since the founding of this nation, had been divided along racial lines. The vast majority of African Americans were enslaved prior to 1865. And so the question of racial politics has always divided the working class in this country. The same was true with Chinese immigrant workers. And so when labor unions began to form, they had a very specific racialized conception of who their constituency was. Many labor unions excluded African Americans altogether, excluded Chinese workers. And so that question of race is profoundly important in the development and the history of the labor movement in this country. But in addition to that is the question of gender. The historian Alice Kessler Harris uses a phrase called the gendered imagination. And what she means by that is that the question of gender and the notion of a man as a breadwinner in a family, as the one who is in fact supporting the family, played a huge role in thinking about why male workers in particular, and in this case white male workers, needed adequate wages was to support their families. The assumptions were very different for women workers. It was assumed that they needed less money since they were not breadwinners. And the assumptions were different for non-white families because the many African-American women and other women of color were employed in the workforce as well. So the question of the male breadwinner ideology didn't apply to families of color the same way it applied to white families. And so labor organizing was very often premised on this notion of the white male breadwinner.
Interesting. And all right, so let's just so that we're clear. I mean, because your book starts, in basically Reconstruction, and then you know things start to heat up, I guess, post World War II. But has the nature of when we say a domestic worker, has the nature of that person? Their job basically remained the same? Has it evolved through the years? Just give us a sense of that.
Yeah. Well, there are certain things that have remained the same. So if we look at the population of women, and it's still largely women today, who are domestic workers, that has shifted dramatically. So whereas in the early 20th century, we saw the vast majority of household workers were African-American women, today the vast majority of household workers are immigrant women. But in addition to that, there has been changes in the kind of work that people do. So while I think the occupation in the early 20th century was one of the servant role, essentially, where upper middle class families or wealthier families would hire a large number of servants in their household to clean, to cook, to take care of the garden. I think today domestic work is less of a status occupation. That is, families don't hire domestic workers today simply to illustrate that they're a part of a particular class position. Today, I think it's more out of necessity, and that has to do with the fact that increasingly numbers of women who used to stay home and do homemaking and caretaking are in the workforce. Because of that, domestic workers are needed to both care for children, to care for elderly parents, to do the household work, and sometimes to do the cooking as well. So I think in many ways, household workers are no longer a luxury as they were in the early part of the 20th century. They are considered today a necessity.
I want to talk about a couple of people's specific stories, but one of the things that strikes me that I think is run in parallel is the notion of home health care workers, we've seen in the past couple of years a lot of issues as to sort of organizing those folks and the perception of what their status as workers is. But it also occurs to me that there's similar problems in terms of organizing. Like, how do you organize people who don't have a factory floor to meet on? And to a certain extent, I guess we're seeing this in the context of like Uber drivers now on some level too, where you have a disparate group of people, but it's obviously easier, it seems to me, now because you have electronic billboards or bulletin boards or some form of that. Give us a sense of like how through the years domestic workers organized. I mean, even starting with the washing society strikes in the 1880s.
Right. That's an excellent question, because many of our models of labor organizing are premised on the notion of collective workspaces. So it's in a collective workspace that workers can share their grievances, can talk about higher pay, can talk about how to organize and how to transform. But domestic workers are located in the privacy of the home. It's not always clear which households are hiring domestic workers. It's not always clear which workers are employed in particular households. So it's a particularly difficult occupation to organize. The washerwomen who organized in Atlanta in 1881, I think, offer one model. And those were African-American women who washed clothes for a living. And they would take in the laundry, and then they would go to a collective workspace and actually wash the clothing together. So that collective workspace served as a platform for them to begin to talk about their rates of pay. And they eventually organized a citywide strike in Atlanta. 3,000 women across the city of Atlanta went on strike to increase their rates of pay. For household workers employed in a household, or for private household workers, it's somewhat different. And the models that I looked at in my research relied on public spaces. So Dorothy Bolden in Atlanta, for example, was a domestic worker who rode the city bus lines, and she rode from the black neighborhoods to the center of the city, where the domestic workers would switch bus lines and then travel out to the largely white neighborhoods in the suburbs. And on those bus lines, Bolden would hand out leaflets and flyers and would talk to women about their minimum wage, about the kind of treatment they received on the job. So public spaces became very important places where workers were able to connect with one another. And interestingly, we see the same kind of thing happening today among domestic workers that are organizing, where public parks the buses and the subways become a site of organizing.
How much pushback was there? And I know that, you know, before we get to that, tell us a little bit about Georgia Gilmore. I mean, maybe it's just because, you know, in the context of buses and public spaces, the domestic workers were very much involved and became, I mean, it's interesting to me to see how the how domestic workers, when they attempted to organize, or when they were organizing, how the broader context of what was going on in terms of social movements at the time implicated their organizing, either as African Americans or as women. And does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And this movement that I write about in the 1960s and the 1970s actually begins in the 1950s, if you include Gilmore in that, was intimately bound up with and tied to both the civil rights movement and the women's movement. And Georgia Gilmore is the perfect example. She was a household worker living in Montgomery, Alabama in the 1950s. And she, like most household workers in Atlanta at the time, relied on the bus system to get to work. The vast majority of household workers didn't have cars, so they had no choice. And Gilmore had had a number of run-ins with bus drivers, and actually had decided to launch her own one-woman boycott. In 1955, well before Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on the bus, and actually it's been 60 years, this is the 60th anniversary of the Montgomery bus boycott. And Georgia Gilmore, once the boycott began, Gilmore decided that she wanted to actively support the boycott. And so she got together with a number of other domestic workers, and they decided to raise money for the boycott effort, which was very expensive. They had to buy insurance, they had to pay for gas for the drivers, they had to post bail money for the individuals who had been arrested. And so Gilmore got together with a number of other workers. They baked pies, they made cakes, they made chicken dinners, and they sold these. And they went to the mass meetings on Mondays and Thursdays, and they handed the money over to the Montgomery Improvement Association. And they very often collected hundreds of dollars every week. And I think her story is especially important for several reasons. One is that it offers us a very different perspective on the civil rights movement and civil rights organizing. It really centers poor and working class African American women who played not just a passive role and not just a role of being foot soldiers in the civil rights movement, but actually playing leadership roles in the civil rights movement.
Let's talk also about the notion of sort of a, well, as we move, I don't want to quite get to where, like, you know, sort of Gloria Steinem comes in and sort of how the domestic workers sort of, I don't know, migrates, but can be seen through also through the women's emancipation in the early 70s, late 60s, I guess, mid 70s as well. But let's talk also about the idea of an oral tradition, this the so-called Bronx slave markets and how those were used in terms of an organizing tool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the most interesting things I discovered was the use of storytelling as a political strategy by domestic workers. You know, and I don't think we can assume that these individuals, these workers necessarily identified as domestic workers. They had multiple identities. But they came to be involved in this movement, and they began to organize as domestic workers in part because of the stories that they told. And they told stories about their own family history, about Black women's collective history. And one of the stories that was most profound for me was the story that Geraldine Miller told. And Miller was a household worker who lived in the Bronx. And she told a story about something called the Bronx Slave Market, which were street corners in the 1930s where African American women stood to be hired as day workers. And apparently, white employers would drive by and look for women with the most scarred knees because those were the women who scrubbed floors down on their hands and knees. And Miller told a story. She had never been a part of the Bronx slave market, but she had heard about it from other women in her neighborhood. And that story became an important indication for her about the ways in which African American women had been exploited in this occupation. But it also became a way that she asserted that there would be reform in the occupation and insisted that African-American women would never again scrub floors down on all fours.
So was the idea that it was both a sense of, like, here's an example of how there's exploitation, but also here's an example of where we have come, you know, how much we have progressed, which is an indication of how much more we can progress?
Well, also an indication of how to reform the occupation, because at the time that Miller was organizing, there were women who were still expected to go down on all fours and scrub the floor. So part of her telling of that story was, I think, to relate to other women who were domestic workers at the time that you really shouldn't be doing this, that this is too much, that this is beyond the call of duty. And, you know, in an age when mops were fairly easy to get, right, that employers would expect workers to get down on their hands and knees.
So what happens in the context of the equal rights for women movement and how that implicates domestic workers? Because Gloria Steinem, I guess, played a pretty big role in pushing for labor reforms for domestic workers.
She did. And the relationship between domestic worker organizations and employers could be very tense. It was white women who were the primary employers of domestic workers, since they were the ones in charge of the household. So when we think about the pay of domestic workers and the treatment of domestic workers, a lot of that really lay at the doorstep of white female employers. So there was a very long history of tension between these two groups. At the same time, there was an emerging women's movement in the 1960s and the 1970s that advocated employment outside the home for middle-class women who had not been working previously. And this, I think, in some ways furthered the tension between working-class domestic workers and then employers. But there was an important segment of the women's movement, and Gloria Steinem was part of it, that really wanted to rethink the relationship between domestic workers and employers. And I think build bonds of solidarity around the issue of why this work was so important. And Gloria Steinem led a campaign to ensure enforcement of the Fair Labor Standards Act, which was amended in 1974 to include domestic workers. And so she was a very important ally that I think represented a very progressive sensibility about the ways in which all women were deeply affected by the degradation of domestic work.
I mean, that's what's sort of fascinating. That aspect I find fascinating, because that relationship with the boss, I guess, in the 50s and 60s and prior, would have been one where there was a lot less opportunity to find any common, I guess, struggle, right? I mean, because it's a racial divide, and a wealthy white woman is not going to find necessarily, or have the sort of there's not a context of consciousness of what she might share with the African American woman that she's paying to do her laundry, take care of her kids, to I don't know, to cook the food. But as there becomes a sort of a, I guess, like intersectional awareness in the 70s, there's room for that type of solidarity. But there's still that tension of, well, I've got to pay you to sort of emancipate myself to go out and work. I've got to still pay you. And if I pay you more, I'm in somehow inhibiting my own ability to go out and work in the labor force.
Absolutely. And, you know, for, you know, much of the history of this occupation, there was an enormous gulf between the worker and the employer. And employers often had a vested interest in distancing themselves from domestic workers because they were, in a sense, doing the dirty work in the household. So there was indeed a lot of tension. So I think it did take the emergence of a feminist movement, the emergence of feminists with a sort of class-based analysis of the importance of this work and why this work had been so marginalized, to create a situation where these bonds of solidarity could begin to be developed. You know, and the other thing I think about this relationship and the way domestic workers in the 1970s sought to build alliances is that it offers us a different model of class-based organizing again. Our normal or our typical understanding of worker organizing is one of confrontation with bosses, of one of sort of making demands on employers. And while there was certainly some of that with the domestic workers, they also sought to build alliances. And this had to do with the very personal nature of the work, where domestic workers were in the homes of their employers and were there every day. And so in a sense, wanted to maintain positive relationships. So it offers a different way to think about how workers can empower themselves.
And what, you know, is there a demand that domestic workers would have that would not be, that and somehow can be from the that can be satisfied from outside of the home? I mean, I'm just trying to draw like a parallel with domestic healthcare workers, right? They that case, particularly in Illinois, where the Supreme Court struck down more or less on a technicality as to whether or not they could be paid through, they could have a union, they could unionize because they were paid via Medicaid or I guess it was Medicaid. Is there an analogy in this world, or is that any type of achievements for domestic worker rights? And I just want to touch on you know, the domestic worker bill of rights that we have in a couple of states, anyways, where the benefits do not necessarily come out of that relationship, or are you know, sort of a zero sum in that relationship with their employer in the home.
Yes. You know, and your mention of the Domestic Worker Bill of Rights is very important in that regard. And even when we think about minimum wage laws are state-mandated laws. It says that workers should be paid a minimum wage, should be paid time and a half beyond 8 hours. And so we have federal and state laws that guarantee workers a certain set of rights. And so the domestic workers in the 1970s pushed for those kinds of state-based protections. They lobbied for an amendment to the Fair Labor Standards Act so they could get minimum wage. They also lobbied for unemployment insurance and similar kinds of rights. Domestic workers today are also advocating state-based protections. And I think especially in a context of today where an increasing number of American workers are precarious workers or contingent workers. In fact, there was a report by the Government Accounting Office that was released in May of this year that said that 40% of American workers are contingent workers. And what that means is they're moving from job to job, and they're very often moving from occupation to occupation, or they're quote-unquote independent contractors or self-employed, as Uber drivers are. And so I think in a context when workers are not tied to a single employer for their lifetime, which was the case for many workers in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, state-based protections become even more important. And I think we have to think about how workers can be granted rights regardless of who they're working for.
And lastly, let me ask you this. How is the sort of institutional memory preserved? I mean, if you talk about Geraldine Miller talking about the Bronx slave markets, and I presume that there was sort of a similar type of oral tradition and passing on struggles through that time in the 20s and the 30s, the post-war, through the 60s and 70s. When there seems to have been a break in terms of who the people are that are filling these roles as domestic workers now. So African Americans, through the 70s, African American women through the 70s, and now to, it seems to me, probably more a fairly recent immigrant population filling that role.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And the primary organization on a national level that's organizing domestic workers today is the National Domestic Workers Alliance. And one of the things they do best is they attempt to educate workers about history and about organizing. So they're very attuned to these issues. They have just initiated what they call the Dorothy Bolden Fellowship for domestic worker organizers, and they're going to announce that in a couple of days. But that's a important indication of the way in which this movement is, in fact, drawing on that history of organizing and attempting to resurrect that and raise that up so that people today understand how domestic workers, in fact, do have this long history of resistance and mobilization.
It's fascinating stuff. Pramila Nadesan, the book is Household Workers Unite, The Untold Story of African American Women Who Built a Movement. We will put a link at majority.fm. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Sam.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. We will head into the fun half of the program in just a moment. Right after, I remind you that it is your memberships that make this program possible. By becoming a member, you are not only basically making it possible for this show to exist on a daily basis, excuse me, still have a cold, but you're also, then we open a door, like a portal to a fun, to a life of fun and sharing in ridicule of some of the insanity that goes on.
I feel like you should
country.
Be saying that in the Hitler voice. Like, part of thought.
Yeah, what were we talking about? Oh, yeah, yeah. We were contemplating today as we were listening to some of the Trump talking to Alex Jones and wondering if this is what the urbane Germans were doing in the in the late 20s, early 30s, as they were mocking Hitler. Like,
look at that mustache. What a loser.
This guy's going nowhere.
A failed artist with no social skills could be president. Sure.
Yeah.
Sure, he'll be chancellor, whatever. But, you know, it's really a good thing.
It you see his comb over? It's hilarious.
No way that's real. That's shoe polish.
And if let me say only we else. Had only we had YouTube and we could watch it over and over again.
We could make it something, they'll call it a meme, and there'll be a mashup of a rap hippity hop song and the voices, and it'll be funny. I wish we had that. But overall, it's good because it exposes the heartland, how bad things have gotten.
Yeah, it's true. The Sudanland now will be cleansed of this. Of course, these characters went on then to become the gay Nazis that we...
Yes.
But little did they know at that time. But
Hitler's speaking sense. Thought experiment.
He's going to show the Chinese a thing or two.
China.
He's going to...
China.
build a huge wall.
I just want Germany to be great again, you know? Just tired of just walking around being weak.
There was
and
a lot of that, actually.
Yeah, there was.
There was a lot of that. Well, the point being, ladies and gentlemen.
I watched this woman about this lady hiking in an ice cave, and I realized she's Germany. We could be like her again. What's her name? Lenny what?
Riefenstahl?
Yeah, that was one of the first propaganda movies that they liked. It was like her. She was like some mountain woman.
Excuse
I just read
me.
A really interesting article about her and Martina Dietrich. Anyways, go ahead.
Martina Dietrich?
Martina Dietrich. Mm. when I watched some clips Marlena of Walt, of Walt Chamberlain.
Sister. Yes.
No, Marlena Dietrich's sister was not good, according to this profile.
Ladies and gentlemen, the point is you can become a member of this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. And not only will you be supporting the show, but we give you an extra at least 50 minutes of bonus content a day. I know, I mean, like this whole week I've been like, we're going to lock it down and keep it tight because I've got a cold. It's not worked out. The only time I seem to have any energy and over the course of the day is those like last half hour of the member show. The rest of the time I'm exhausted. But we got to wrap it up. Wait a second. I just got my second wind. And then then it's completely blown out for the rest of the day. Also, I should remind you folks that what makes a great gift, not just for Hanukkah or for Christmas, Eid probably not so much, right? It's caffeine, right? Mm. That's not, but never.
Well, Ramadan is when you fast.
But caffeine? No? Is that?
Muslims can have caffeine. I can't believe you don't know this as I guess, a secret Muslim yourself.
I'm confusing. Yes. But it's certainly bad for more
Turkish coffee, yeah. Dude.
Right, of course. Yeah. All right. Well, so nevertheless, this is a great gift for everyone who's not Mormon. Sorry, Mormons. There's chocolate.
There's decaf.
Oh, and there's decaf. All right. So fair enough. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. The shipping is free. The coffee's great. And if you use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Plus, you can buy the Majority Report blend. We get a kickback for all of that. But I'm telling you, it's great coffee. You'll be hooked. I mean, because caffeine's addictive. But you'll be hooked on this specific type of coffee. You won't get your generic caffeine fix. So justcoffee.coop. And again, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me via the app. Tomorrow on the program, Cliff Schechter will be here. And I think John Benjamin will join us to talk about his new jazz album. Not in studio. I'm sorry, Kelly. We'll be right back after this.